Welcome to Cybershow Reflections, fixing the system with Andy Farnell and Helen Plews. In this episode, Helen is reading from and analysing the work of Dana Meadows, one of the greatest systems thinkers. She'll be reading from Leverage Points, Where to Intervene in a System.
As part of the study of security and software engineering, we must see Meadows' ideas as a vital contribution to any rational challenge to the myriad problems of defective, invasive, insecure, and inevitably dystopian technology. Broken, illegible, and overcomplex systems are what we have, but they are not inevitable. They arise from a failure of our project to incorporate human values into tech. In our insane clamour for growth and progress, we have forgotten why we build systems in the first place. When talking about systems theory in this context, we are talking more about systems we design than systems we simply observe to have evolved in nature. We design and build them with intent, so we can build them to free us or enslave us. We can positively design and change systems rather than let them evolve as accidents of technological determination or abdication of agency to the religion of markets. But in order to correct the toxic symphony of greedy big tech, broken universities, reckless research, corrupt governments, and a credulous, misled population, we must see that all these systems are totally of our own creation and will, absolutely changeable in any way we wish, and unfortunately, a proxy non-kinetic battleground for old ideologies and powers. No thinker since Marceau has more lucidly enumerated and ranked a taxonomy of systematic, useful relations. Their understanding and practical application is within the reach of every layperson. They are the antidote to the cynical bureaucracy of Max Weber or the insane systematics of John Gall. They explain in a single flash how the bullshit economics of David Graeber and narcissistic economics of Harry Frankfurt can be consigned to history and guide us into a more rational age. Places to Intervene in a System, from Thinking in Systems by Dana Meadows. So, how do we change the structure of systems to produce more of what we want and less of that which is undesirable? After years of working with corporations on their systems problems, MIT's Jay Forrester likes to say that the average manager can define the current problem, identify the system structure that leads to the problem, and guess, with great accuracy, where to look for leverage point places in the systems where a small change could lead to a large shift in behavior. This idea of leverage points is not unique to system analysis. It's embedded in legend, the silver bullet, the trim trap, the miracle cure, the secret passage, and the magic password. The single hero who turns the tide of history, the nearly effortless way to cut through or leap over huge obstacles. We not only want to believe that there are leverage points, we want to know where they are and how to get our hands on them. Leverage points are points of power. But Forrester goes on to point out that although people deeply involved in a system often know intuitively where to find leverage points, more often than not, they push the change in the wrong direction. The classic example of that backward intuition was my own introduction to systems analysis, the World Model. Asked by the Club of Rome, an international group of businessmen, statesmen, and scientists, to show how major global problems of poverty and hunger, environmental destruction, resource depletion, urban deterioration, and unemployment are related to how they might be solved, Forrester made a computer model and came out with a clear leverage point: growth. Not only population growth, but economic growth. Growth has costs as well as benefits, and we typically don't count those costs, among which are poverty and hunger, environmental destruction, and so on, the whole list of problems we are trying to solve with growth. What is needed is much slower growth, very different kinds of growth, and in some cases, no growth or negative growth. The world's leaders are correctly fixated on economic growth as the answer to virtually all problems, but they're pushing with all their might in the wrong direction. Another of Forrester's classics was a study of urban dynamics published in 1969, which demonstrated that subsidized low-income housing is a leverage point. The less of it there is, the better off the city is, even the low-income folks in the city. This model came out at a time when national policy dictated massive low-income housing projects and Forrester was derided. Since then, many of those projects have been torn down in city after city. Counterintuitive. That's Forrester's word to describe complex systems. Leverage points frequently are not intuitive. Or if they are, we too often use them backward, systematically worsening whatever problems we are trying to solve. I have come up with no quick or easy formulas for finding leverage points in complex systems. Give me a few months or years and I'll figure it out. And I know from bitter experience, that's because they are so counterintuitive. When I do discover a system's leverage points, hardly anyone will believe me. Very frustrating, especially for those of us who yearn not just to understand complex systems, but to make the world work better. It was in just such a moment of frustration that I proposed a list of places to intervene in a system during a meeting of implications of global trade regimes. I offer this list to you with much humility and wanting to leave room for its evolution. What bubbled up in me that day was distilled from decades of rigorous analysis of many different kinds of systems done by many smart people. But complex systems are, well, complex. It's dangerous to generalize about them. What you read here is still a work in progress. It's not a recipe for finding leverage points. Rather, it's an invitation to think more broadly about system change.
Now let's hear a few of Helen's own thoughts on Dana's introduction.
Within the very first part of Dana Meadows' work, in that very introduction, you're immediately transported to a place of thinking about the world as a complex social and political system. We think far too individually in terms of not just ourselves and our families, but as a city, a county, a country, or group of allies. We often don't look at humanity as a functioning natural system, one that has evolved over a really, really long period of time. Then we build our own technological and social and political systems on top as a sort of patch and wonder why they just don't seem to work to fix the issues. And in 2023, we have a huge pile of issues that just seem to be building that we're not able to patch. Maybe we need to start listening to our experts who so far haven't been believed or listened to, because it's difficult for humanity to look at itself collectively, to see itself as a highly modified worldwide human system. She's right. Our system is far too focused on economic growth, and that's a cause of depressions and hardships, as well as a small number of mega winners. We create a roller coaster system with ups and downs, winners and losers, extreme poverty and extreme wealth, instead of a calmer, resilient one.
Now let's count our way down through all of Dana Meadows' leverage points in reverse order, from the least effective to the most effective. Let's begin at number 12 with parameters.
Number 12.
Numbers, constants, such as subsidies, taxes, standards. think about the basic stock and flow bathtub from chapter one. The size of the flow is a matter of numbers and how quickly those numbers can be changed. Maybe the faucet turns hard, so it takes a while to get the water flowing or to turn it off. Maybe the drain is blocked and can allow only a small flow, no matter how open it is. Maybe the faucet can deliver with the force of a fire hose. Some of these kinds of parameters are physically locked in and unchangeable, but many can be varied, and so are popular intervention points. Consider the national debt. It may seem like a strange stock. It is a money hole. The rate at which the hole deepens is called the annual deficit. Income from taxes shrinks the hole, government expenditures expand it. Congress and the president spent most of their time arguing about the many, many parameters that increase spending and decrease taxing. The size or depth of the hole. Since those flows are connected to us, the voters, these are politically charged parameters. But despite all the fireworks, no matter which party is in charge, the money hole has been deepening for years now, just at different rates. To adjust the dirtiness of the air we breathe, the government sets parameters called ambient air quality standards to ensure some standing stock of forest or some flow of money to logging companies. It sets allowed annual cuts. Corporations adjust parameters such as wage rates and product prices, with an eye on the levels in their profit bathtub, the bottom line. The amount of land we set aside for conservation each year, the minimum wage, how much we spend on AIDS research or stealth bombers, the service charge the bank extracts from your account, all of these are parameters, adjustments to faucets. So, by the way, is firing people and getting new ones, including politicians. Putting different hands on the faucet may change the rate at which the faucets turn, but if they're the same old faucets plumbed into the same old system, turned according to the same old information, goals and rules, the system behaviour isn't going to change much. Electing Bill Clinton was definitely different from electing the elder George Bush, but not all that different, given that every president is plugged into the same political system. Changing the way money flows in that system would make much more of a difference, but I'm getting ahead of myself on this list. Numbers, the sizes of flows, are dead last on my list of powerful interventions. Diddling with the details, arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Probably 99% of our attention goes to parameters, but there's not a lot of leverage in them. It's not that the parameters aren't important, they can be, especially in the short term, and to the individual who's standing directly in the flow. People care deeply about such variables as taxes and the minimum wage, and so fight fierce battles over them. But changing these variables rarely changes the behaviour of the national economy system. If the system is stagnant, parameter changes rarely kickstart it. If it's widely variable, they usually don't stabilise it. If it's growing out of control, they don't slow it down. Whatever cap we put on campaign contributions, it doesn't clean up politics. The Fed's fiddling with the interest rate hasn't made business cycles go away. We always forget that during the upturns and are shocked, shocked by the downturns. After decades of the strictest air pollution standards in the world, Los Angeles air is less dirty, but it isn't clean. Spending more on police doesn't make crime go away. Since I'm about to get stuck into some examples where parameters are leverage points, let me stick in a big caveat here. Parameters become leverage points when they go into ranges that kick off one of the items higher on the list. Interest rates, for example, or birth rates, control the gains around reinforcing feedback loops. system goals are parameters that can make big differences. These kind of critical numbers are not nearly as common as people seem to think they are. Most systems have evolved or are designed to stay far out of range of critical parameters. Mostly, the numbers are not worth the sweat put into them. Here's a story a friend sent me over the internet to make that point. When I became a landlord, I spent a lot of time and energy trying to figure out what would be a fair rent to charge. I tried to consider all the variables, including the relative income of my tenants, my own income, and cash flow needs, which expenses were for upkeep and which were capital gains, the equity versus the interest proportion of the mortgage payments, how much my labour on the house was worth, etc. I got absolutely nowhere. Finally, I went to someone who specialises in giving money advice. She said, "You're acting as though there is a fine line at which the rent is fair. And at any point above that point, the tenant is being screwed. And at any point below that, you are being screwed. In fact, there is a large grey area in which both you and the tenant are getting a good or at least a fair deal. Stop worrying and get on with your life."
So, what are the basic parameters of digital technology? Bytes of memory, speed of a processor measured in hertz, or dollars per gigaflop of computing power? These have all grown exponentially for over 60 or 70 years, but in reality, the base utility of computing has remained almost constant. Perhaps, like the six basic plots of drama, there are only a handful of primitive utilities that computers can offer us. Ada Lovelace enumerated them in the mid-19th century, and we have been reinventing the same basic apps: the word processor, the spreadsheet calculator, the database, the network messenger, and so on, over and over again. Each time they get faster, their user interfaces change, sometimes for the better, sometimes not. But we do not. As capacity grows, we find more to store. As efficiency increases, we generate work to fill the capability. And with more capability comes more complexity. And with more complexity comes, paradoxically, less systemic stability or reliability. In the past decade, many computerized tasks have grown slower. And many jobs are now intolerable in the age of pointless technological make-work and dignity-stripping security requirements. Have computers made our lives better? It is and will remain an endlessly arguable point. Might it be fair to say that technology is a form of tragedy? Or just that we insist on being tragic and making it a prop in our cursed play? With perhaps the exception of some network effects, behaviours at scale, due as much to globalism as the technology itself, it's not quantity that steers the path of computing. As Meadows says, it's the qualitative shifts that emerge from the crossing of certain thresholds. With advancing digital technology, the more things change, the more they stay the same, until suddenly they don't. When they cross suddenly into an unrecognisable territory. Certainly, we are set to add a few new plots to the playbook. Firm belief in the unreliable oracle, the mechanical friend and golem, the homunculean policeman, the digital superegos to keep our thoughts pure, and negligent protectors and defective guardians. These are all entering the stage through AI at present. Meadows is spot on with this observation with regards to digital technology, whose surface features of purely measurable values seem to have almost no significance in themselves. Take, for example, large language models at the basis of new developments in AI. These are, in any fair analysis, really the result of brute force. They're qualitative changes that have come about by crossing the threshold, achievable by gains made in compounding quantity upon quantity upon quantity for over 30 years. Number 11 is buffers or capacitors.
Number 11.
11. The sizes of buffers and other stabilizing stocks relative to their flows. Consider a huge bathtub with slow in and outflows. And now think about a small one with very fast flows. That's the difference between a lake and a river. You hear about catastrophic river floods much more often than catastrophic lake floods, because stocks that are big relative to their flows are more stable than small ones. In chemistry and other fields, a big stabilizing stock is known as a buffer. The stabilizing power of buffers is why you keep money in the bank rather than living from the flow of change through your pocket. It's why stores hold inventory instead of calling for new stock, just as customers carry the old stock out of the door. It's why we need to maintain more than the minimum breeding population of an endangered species. Soils in the eastern US are more sensitive to acid rain than soils in the west because they haven't got big buffers of calcium to neutralize acid. You can often stabilize a system by increasing the capacity of a buffer, but if a buffer is too big, the system gets inflexible. It reacts too slowly. And big buffers of some sorts, such as water reserves or inventories, cost a lot to build or maintain. Businesses invented just-in-time inventories because occasional vulnerability to fluctuations or screw-ups is cheaper, for them anyway, than certain constant inventory costs. And because small to vanishing inventories allow more flexible response to shifting demand. There's leverage, sometimes magical, in changing the size of buffers. But buffers are usually physical entities, not easy to change. The acid absorption capacity of eastern soils is not a leverage point for alleviating acid rain damage. The storage capacity of a dam is literally cast in the concrete. So I haven't put buffers very high on the list of leverage points.
Although in general, Meadows points to buffers as leverage points that might be increased for stability or reduced for speed, in tech, the problem is almost entirely a dearth of proper buffering. Technology makes us lazy and complacent, craving for convenience and overconfident in the capability and resilience of our technology. Buffers are redundancy. Buffers are not firing the sysadmin because you moved all your infra to the cloud and now pay someone else's sysadmin to keep your stuff unsafely on someone else's computer. That's like firing all the doctors because people seem well today. Buffers are excess bandwidth provision, multi-homing, triple modular redundancy in critical systems. Buffers are a three-tiered backup system with multiple off-site storage. Buffers are not buying cheap IoT and AI crap to do a human's job. Buffers are expensive insurance for the future. And like all insurance, buffers are betting against your own good luck. But it will run out.
In computing, we are all very used to buffers, from our CPUs in our end devices, all the way to the basic system designs that have buffers very much built into them from their beginning. However, it isn't always a benefit, as Meadows points out, to have a large and excessive buffer across those systems. And just like the dam analogy, computers, servers, and the systems they're connected to have a finite concrete wall. We are also limited in those buffer sizes by technology requirement and the budgets they require. It would be potentially ideal to some extent running a system with all the top spec memory and with excess servers ready to dynamically spread their load. So a system never sows at any point. But the reality of this is non-existent and wasteful. It would give us a great buffer and increase security, but at what cost? And would it be useful to put a buffer on those steady flows? Meadows has given us an answer here. There are leverage points in buffers, but they are only useful on fast flows. For our system design, we must pick apart that data. What can be categorized as a lake or a steady flow? Data which is predictable with a steady in and out won't require huge buffers. Then we can focus on the fast phase, data that changes dynamically. Every business has a sales inbox which will dynamically change throughout the year, especially in the December period. Applying a big buffer here makes sense. It will give you that leverage. Even better, we can predict when those buffers are needed. Maybe it's only for 3 months of the year, for example. The leverage here would be providing a well-researched buffer for just those period, reducing cost and creating a strong leverage point with our buffer. We need to look at our system and data flows, categorize them as slow or fast, work out if a buffer is a leverage point, and if we can, apply it at the right time and in the right places. If we can do this across the entire system, we are maxing our buffer leverage point for our resilient system design.
In this episode, we dove deep into the world of systems theory and game theory, unveiling their profound importance in the realm of cybersecurity. Dana Meadows' insights have shed light on how understanding the interconnected systems and strategic decision-making can fortify our defences against ever-evolving cyber threats. Remember, in the complex and dynamic landscape of cybersecurity, these theories serve as our guiding principles, empowering us to anticipate, adapt, and protect our digital domains. So, as you navigate this ever-changing landscape, remember that embracing these theories can be the key to not just fixing the systems, but securing them for a safer digital future. As always, thank you for tuning in to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.